And that has got to be one of the most rewarding ways I've ever shared music. We talk about the research and, the connection music can make with between people and audiences and the effects on the brain, but that level of intimacy and sharing it in that way really was the first time I really saw in real time just how much the impact of music and connection can benefit our lives.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Canadian violinist Yolanda Bruno spoke to me about her new album, Dear Jean, and her film, The Immortal Seraphine, which both honor the late Jean Lemann, the renowned Baroque violinist and music director of Tafelmusik for 34 years. Yolanda explains how she explores the story of Jean's 1759 Santo Serafine Baroque violin, which was generously loaned to Yolanda for 1 year. You'll hear a few clips from the album, including Jean's masterful string trio arrangement of Bach's iconic Chaconne, as well as a taste of a LeClair duo with Julia Wedman, another important mentor for Yolanda, and a work by Beth Silver honoring Jean's Dutch Jewish heritage. Yolanda reflects on what it means to live more sustainably with her partner, the accordionist Michael Bridge, who was previously featured on this podcast. She shared how her annual project, Music for Your Blues, has impacted her life, as well as a very memorable experience performing in a high-security penitentiary, which taught her about connection and dignity and the value of live music. I also wanted to shine a light on Yolanda's brilliant first album, The Wild Swans, featuring 11 women composers, recorded with pianist Isabel David. You'll hear short excerpts by Leira Auerbach and Kelly Marie Murphy. We end the episode with Yolanda's insights about avoiding burnout by achieving balance in her life, using the idea of longer cycles of time, which I loved. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring you these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hey, Yolanda, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me, Leah.
I'm glad we could make this work. We're both so busy. And as we record this, you're expecting a child. And when this is released, you will be a parent. So that's a big life change.
It is a little bit surreal knowing that by the time this is out into the world, my life will have changed forever.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. You have to go through it. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on your two most recent projects, which are so beautiful. And we're really going to dig into those as well as some of your other life and music. So I really loved watching your film, The Immortal Seraphine. How will people be able to see this? Is it going to be linked to your website? How's it going to work?
That is a very good question. So actually, just this afternoon, I'll be meeting with the other producer of this film, the director, Rob DeVito, and we will be discussing some of the next steps. And so it might be that it'll be in the similar format to what we did in Toronto at the launch, where it is part performance and part film in the second half of a concert. So if you're in Ottawa, you might be able to see it this coming summer, 2026. Okay. Or if you're in Winnipeg, you might be able to see it in fall 2026. So we're hoping to get it on the road across Canada to actually be viewed live with groups of people through music before it goes potentially online in some fashion where the general public can access it from the comfort of their home.
Okay, cool. Well, at the moment, my second, the city with the most listeners is in Melbourne, Australia, so they'll have to wait.
Wonderful. They'll have to wait a little longer, yeah. But hopefully we'll get it to you very soon. That's great.
So this special violin was owned and played on by your teacher and mentor, Jean Lemann. I have to say, I always wondered why she spelled her name like that, and then I was interested to learn about that. Can you speak to her name a little bit?
Yes. So Jean, the way that she spelled it for most of her adult life was J-E-A-N-N-E. But when she was born, it was spelled J-E-A-N. And there was confusion of that name being Jean in French, which is a male name. At the time that Jean was music director of Tafel Musik, and really these realities still exist, it was so rare to have a music director that was a woman. And this is the time before, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all this social life that we live on computers. And so she would get hired for projects with Tafel Musik or other projects and then would show up, and then the promoters would be surprised to see a woman because they thought it was Jean Lamont. It was a French man. And so to avoid any confusion, she changed the spelling of her name to Jean as we know it, just so that was clear.
Yeah. And her violin, this beautiful Seraphine, first of all, can you tell us that you must have got a very difficult phone call when you found out that she was very ill?
Yeah, this was in the middle of the pandemic when we were all at home. And we had spoken on the phone, but also we had met a few times with Christina just in this format over video. I actually played for Jean a little bit online. And we kept in touch that way. And she had told me that she was sick, but she didn't really reveal just how sick she was. And it wasn't until she was really close to the end that I then realized, like, I won't see Jean again in person. In a way, I think she was protecting some people by not really revealing just the extent of it, knowing that we couldn't all get together and see one another. So it was really devastating to learn she was 71. She was so young. And this is somebody with so much energy, big, vibrant personality, still performing, recording, moving around, doing yoga classes every day with her partner, Christina, doing pottery in the morning. They were just bustling people with lots of life. And it was a huge shock. And it's a very heavy and sad thing. But life is extremely fragile. And we just don't know when our chapter in this current plane of existence, we don't know when it'll be over.
So most people will have heard of Tafel Musik, but not everyone. Can you speak to that group a little bit? And you were never a member, but you played with them.
I've played with Tafel Musik. I was never a member of the Tafel Musik Baroque Orchestra. So what you're asking about is this album that I made, this project that I recorded on my former teacher's violin, a Santo Serafin violin. And Jean Lamont was the music director for, I believe, 33 years of the Tafel Musik Baroque Orchestra that are based here in Toronto. They are maybe like 15 players, a small group, and a very versatile ensemble that play on period instruments, old instruments, historic instruments on gut strings and period bows. And she built this ensemble into a world-class organization, and they had a big record deal with Sony in the early days, and they were touring all over the place, and she built a very different dynamic orchestra from the orchestras that existed here in Toronto, like the symphony where I work, or the Canadian Opera Company, or the ballet. This was like the new edgy group in town. And it still remains that kind of ensemble, and it draws that kind of crowd that are there to experience something a little bit more dynamic. Like, the players are standing, sometimes they're playing from memory. It's just sometimes there are multimedia productions that are happening in combination with their live music. And it's taking old music, and then often they find interesting ways of bridging some new repertoire or working with living composers. It's like, it's really cool to see how they've bridged both past and present at the same time. They're a great ensemble, Tafel Musik Baroque Orchestra.
And this violin is on loan to you temporarily that belonged to her. So can you tell us about that phone call?
Right. It was on loan. So this was about a week after Jean passed. Christina Mahler, Jean's partner of 43 years, called and told me that Jean's instrument will be donated to the Canada Council for the Arts, that we've decided that that's where we would like to share this instrument, and that it will remain a Baroque instrument. It will be the first one in their collection that's not a modern violin, and that's really significant because they're quite rare. They're hard to come by, especially very good quality old Baroque instruments. And then she said, it'll take about a year for the paperwork to go through, and Jean wanted to know and wanted to offer this instrument to play on for a year. And I just like burst into tears. Such a gift to be offered this instrument, to have had my former mentor and teacher, you know, think of me in that way, to know that she knew that how much that would benefit me in my own growth as I explored Baroque music, because it's just so hard to get access to those good instruments. And I had the great privilege of playing on this antique old Venetian violin from Italy, an almost 300-year-old instrument that was exquisite. And I got to know my old teacher more intimately by playing this violin. And I realized, okay, this is it. I've got about, you know, like 13 months with this violin. What do we do in that time? So I called a good friend of mine, Chantal Lemire, who's a former school friend from my McGill years. We were very, very close. And I said, she's a grant writer. And I said, do you think we can make this grant happen? It's like, it's due in 3 weeks. I want to record an album. And I think I want to make a documentary film about this violin. And we scrambled and we worked like hours and hours and hours for a few days in a row. And we got this grant in and we were successful and we got this project going. So it all happened really quickly. We got into the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. We had support from them as well through someone named Trisha Baldwin and a program called the Imagine Program. And if you are a young Canadian artist, I highly recommend you look into this program, the Imagine Program at the Isabel Bader Center. And we recorded the album there in that space. It's a stunning all-wood concert hall right beside Lake Ontario, so like right by nature. It's a hall that Jean knew really well. The acoustics are incredible. And we recorded music, which we can talk about later. And then the next portion of my work was the documentary film. So working with Rob DeVito, who was the director and producer with me, and also my partner Michael Bridge was very, very involved in the storyline production of that project and putting the film together, which was a story about this instrument, the Santo Serafin violin that belonged to Jean Lamont. How did she get the instrument? What does it mean to have an old instrument? How does something so old survive almost 200 and something years and 80 years or so? So that was the project.
Mm-hmm. One of the most special things on this album is actually Jean's arrangement of the Bach Chaconne. So I thought we could play a short clip of that to give people a taste of this really incredible arrangement.
I'd love for you to play that clip. It is a stunning piece of music. It's about 12 minutes long. The context of the Chaconne, so it's written for solo violin by Bach in, I don't know, 1720. And the story is that Bach had been on a tour in Europe for maybe 2 or 3 months. And in that time, his wife, his first wife, passed away. And they had written to him, but because he was on the move, he never received the letters saying that she had died. So he returned home after having been away for a long time to discover his wife has passed. And we don't know for sure, but it's quite likely that this Chaconne was the first piece that he wrote after learning that news. What we do know for sure is that the manuscript, the paper he wrote it on, was paper that he bought while on tour. And in this work, I mean, you can spend a lifetime dissecting this work. Many people have made relationships between the five stages of grief and this work, you know, moments of like complete anger and pain, and then like bargaining, and then this sense of acceptance, how he goes back into this major key and the way he does that transition. It's just a profoundly deep work. And it really is perfect in how it's written for solo violin. And it's hard to believe, but Jean has taken this work and has arranged it for three people, for two violins and cello. And it is just as amazing as the original, and if not more magical. Because now she's given this opportunity where there's more space for each. There's so much going on in the original, and now she's given each individual this opportunity to express something even more profound through these individual lines. It's just stunning. It's hard to describe in words, but she's made something truly magical in this arrangement. And so on the album, I've asked Christina Mahler, Jean's partner, 43 years, to play on cello. And then one of the violinists who I admire the most in the world today, Julia Wedman, who's also someone who has been a teacher and a mentor in many ways. She plays the other violin part in this trio arrangement of Bach's solo violin Chaconne, arranged by Jean Lemann.
You know, this album is linked to this film, which people won't have seen, but if we could talk about the film a little bit. So one of your major themes in it, Yolanda, is the fragility of these beautiful old instruments and the fragility of our planet.
You're right. I'm trying to pull up a photo that maybe you can see the violin. Just it's so nice to have a visual of it. So the album you're referring to is this one, Dear Jean. So that is the beautiful violin on the cover there. And then this is Jean playing the violin. And the film is about, it's called The Immortal Seraphim, and it's about how Jean acquired the instrument, which is a really interesting story. But you specifically asked about its tie to the environment. Mm-hmm. So the violin's made in 1759, but the woods that would have been needed to make an instrument that at that time would need to come from a tree that's like at least 100 years old. So we're looking at a tree from maybe the mid 1600s. And to, you know, pick up an old violin and to know that you're holding wood that's almost 400 years old is just, when you really think about it, it's extraordinary. That's pre-industrial revolution. The planet that this wood was living on is a totally different world than the one that we live in today. And you start looking at these pieces of wood and you can see the grains, and that indicates all the years that the tree was growing. And when they are very, very close together, those little grains, that indicates that they were growing slowly. Like we can actually see what type of winter and what type of summer that tree endured based on the records that we can see in this wood. And that's remarkable, very, very special. And then in the film, we talk about some of the woods that are no longer accessible, like ebony, which is on the fingerboard of the violin, is a wood from Madagascar. That's now an endangered wood. You cannot harvest from Madagascar anymore. The beautiful violin at the back is maple wood, and spruce wood on the front of the violin. It's exquisite. And you look at this antique instrument and you're playing it and you think, everything else I own, you know, is like, was made a few years ago and is disposable. It's designed to break so that we buy a new one. But this instrument was built to last. It was likely commissioned by somebody who had money, and it was built over the course of several months and was meant to go out into the world to be played and then for other people to see this quality instrument and then to go back to the original maker and ask, oh, can I also have a Santo Seraphim? And that kind of concept that something so old that's 300 years old could still be used today. I mean, what else in our house do we use that's 300 years old that can still benefit us in some way today is really remarkable. And I can't help but think, when I'm holding such an old instrument, something so fragile, that, you know, it's a representation of another time that we lived on this planet, and where will this violin be in 300 years from now? And can we look at this beautiful instrument and see, oh my goodness, how lucky are we to live in this gorgeous world? And how can we make sure that it's available to the next generation that comes after us? There's this beautiful concept, I believe Haudenosaunee believe in the seven generation sustainability, indigenous concept of looking at the decisions you make now, how will they impact seven generations into the future? And that's what I think about when I'm holding such an old instrument. It's like, where will this instrument be in decades from now, in a century from now, when I'm long gone and forgotten? What are the decisions we're making today that are impacting the world that people will live on tomorrow when we're gone?
So are there things, it must change, like, for all of us, but are there things you're trying to do right now to be more sustainable?
Yes. Everything from what I'm buying, where do the products come from? Are they coming from other parts of the world? Are they coming from just around the corner in the province I live in Ontario or in Toronto? How much plastic is on this product that I can't recycle? Do I need a new phone? This phone has been cracked for 18 months, but it's still working fine. Rogers is really keen on me buying another phone, so I get messages from them all the time asking me to upgrade. So it's kind of looking at disposability culture, looking at where products are coming from, looking at what we eat is a big one. Not to preach about food, and everybody's relationship to food is different, but my partner is pretty strict vegan. He says he's freegan, meaning he'll have some dairy, but he doesn't eat any meat and fish. And that's for ethical and environmental reasons. And kind of learning from him a lot about that. I didn't know anything about that until we were together. So those are some of the decisions and things I think about in terms of environmental sustainability and how we live and how we consume. My decisions are so small, you know, how you transport yourself. Do you go on a bike or do you go in a car? Can you be four people in a car instead of one person in a car? I hope we're making a difference. We have a long, long way to go, as you know.
Yeah. So actually, I will be linking a few related episodes to yours. And one of them will be Michael Bridge, the accordionist, which people may not realize he's your life partner.
Yes, Michael's my life partner, and we are expecting our first child very, very soon, in about 5 weeks from now. By the time this episode airs, I believe our little baby girl will have entered the world. We're really excited about that.
So you mentioned he helped a lot with the creating sort of the storyline of this film.
Yes. So Michael and I are, you know, just as you said, life partner. We're also, in so many ways, artistic partners, even though we don't necessarily do projects together at the same time. We are always bouncing ideas off of each other. I really would love to be a fly on the wall of normal people's relationships, because we talk about music or about art and about what we're working on all the time, and that is exciting for us. It was Michael's idea to actually have a film about the violin. He thought, the album is great, but how could you really, through a story and through speaking, talk about this instrument? And that can live on more than just in music. And so we had originally conceptualized a 15-minute documentary. The documentary is closer to 45 minutes. And he and I discussed the different ways of bringing that story to life. And one was through looking at the environment, looking at sustainability, looking at how this is a piece of wood, it's part of nature, and yet it's still here 300 years later. And then we also interview Rick Heinel, the violin antiquarian in Toronto, and he speaks more to who Serafin was as a violin maker in Venice, and the different aspects of, like, the exquisite refinement in how he crafted this violin. Santo Serafin did. Rick Heinel's interview is one of my, is just such a profound interview. He's so, so passionate about violins and about old instruments, and is very knowledgeable. Then we interview Ottie Lockey, who was the former managing director of Tafelmusik for 19 years. And she worked, and she and Jean Lemans started on the first day at Tafelmusik together. They both joined at the same time. And they were good friends and good working partners. And she talks about that relationship, like what Jean was like as a boss, as a dynamic leader, as someone making decisions about the organization, that she included everybody, that she was a very collaborative person in her leadership role. And then the final interview is with Jack Lavoie. And maybe you know, do you remember Jack from the days he was in Ottawa? So Jack was, you know, he also did restorations on instruments, but he also collected instruments and went to auctions and purchased. He's so knowledgeable also about old and fine instruments. And Jack is responsible for having found the seraphin for Jean Lemann. He knew that Jean specifically wanted a seraphin violin. And one had come up for auction, at this auction, and Jean went to try to bid, but it went far out of their price range for the bidding. And then another seraphin came up for sale again, and he called her like the day before. It's like, it's tomorrow. It is a seraphin. It is authentic. I think you should come check it out. So within 24 hours, she's in New York looking at this ancient instrument. It's set up as a modern violin. And she has only 15 minutes to decide whether or not she wants to buy this instrument that is, you know, this is like 1992 or 91. And I think the instrument was like 83, starting at 80,000 American, something like that. Like, stick a lot of money, and you have to make this decision in just a matter of minutes. And apparently she's in a room with all of these other players. That's how Jack is describing it. It's like kind of chaotic and it's noisy. They're all playing, like hacking away, trying to decide, do I like this one? And she's the only player that has like no shoulder rest, no chin rest. And she's just got it there in her hands. And she's trying to gauge, like, do I like this instrument? And two, like, how will it survive a restoration process? Because you just don't know exactly what the instrument will sound like after it undergoes a big transformation. And she decided to take that chance, and that's the instrument that she bid on, and she won the bid and she took it home, and it underwent, I think, an 8-month restoration process. And that's the violin that you'll hear on all of the Juno award-winning Tafel Musik recordings. It's just the instrument that most of her career was on, this beautiful Santo Seraphin. So that's the film in a nutshell.
Yeah. It was interesting because it mentioned that she went to Bill Monocle on Staten Island for the restoration. I had been to see him when I bought my Baroque violin many years ago. And certainly, like, in the Baroque world, there's this sort of bias or thought that the original state of the instruments is less tension on the instrument, and therefore they breathe better. That was always my idea. And I always felt sort of guilty about the modernization somehow, like we're putting all this tension. But Rick Heinel, actually, in that interview, he had a different opinion. He talked about the potential of the box was enhanced. And I never thought about it that way, because it's true. Like, we make much bigger sounds with the modernization. So I guess I feel less guilty as, like, you know what I mean?
Yes. I think that both have their value.
Yeah.
The original setup was designed for... I won't speak to what Rick said, because it is, like, it's not obviously controversial, but, like, it could be that he has his own bias.
Yeah.
That he prefers the other setup, the modern setup, and that for him that means it's reached its full potential. Mm. For somebody else, they feel that the other voice was the instrument's, like, place. That's how it was supposed to be designed. It depends what your relationship is to which setup.
Yeah.
But I agree with both in different scenarios. So don't feel bad about having modernized your instrument. That's absolutely fine.
Well, my instrument is not that old, but it probably was modernized at a certain point. But I, the instrument I bought from Bill, I no longer have it, but it was like an old English instrument that hadn't been, like, it was the original setup.
Oh, wonderful.
It was cool. And I did go play for Jean. I was young. I'd studied Baroque violin and I wanted to make that connection, but she didn't like the instrument. She said, she was very forthright. She said, I don't know, it's boxy. You know what I mean? It's boxy. I'm not sure what she meant by that, but
it's so personal.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe for her it was, but for you it wasn't at all. And maybe in your hands it's not boxy. And it's so interesting with violins. It's very personal. You know, you and I are speaking right now, and you have a certain quality in your voice, and I have a different quality in my voice. And that's like a violin. I'm born with this voice. You're born with your voice.
But it's also what I could afford.
That too. Yes. Not everybody can have an old Santo Seraphin violin.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed, I played a lot of Baroque chamber music, and you'd also grew up in Ottawa, but you're a different generation. So you wouldn't have been around at that time. But yeah, for me, it was exploring the 150 years before Bach, like getting to know all that repertoire was so great. And I should really pass on some of my collection of music to you. I was thinking when I listened to your beautiful LeClaire duo, I think I still have it. I bought facsimiles of all, you know, LeClaire wrote something like 42 violin sonatas with continuo. And I think I have the facsimiles for all of those.
No way. Yeah, I'd love to take a look at that. I know we think also what you just said is very true. Bach is actually at the end of the Baroque spectrum. Like there's so much music that comes before that I also am, it's, you know, it's new to me as well. And it's much less performed in the sort of symphony or like chamber music realms that are a little bit more prominent in Canada.
So I stopped playing Baroque violin because I didn't really have a context going forward. And actually I had kids and I had this full-time orchestra job. So I just decided, you know, let's just lean into the modern thing and use the money to have a better modern violin, which I think was the right choice for me and my career. But I do miss it. And I have to say, like, I regret I didn't hear Tafel music the couple times they came with Jean because I felt sad. I like missed that world. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So I made the decision not to go to these concerts, which I do regret. But how do you feel going between? Because it's so different.
I just want to say how profoundly beautiful that is. That obviously indicates just like how meaningful that journey was for you playing on gut strings. Your question was, how do you go between these two worlds?
Yeah.
They really are two different worlds. I mean, I first picked up a Baroque violin in 2018 and I thought, okay, it's good to tell the story of how that happened. I came back to Canada and I was looking for a job and because I'd been in Europe for 5 years and I didn't really know what direction to take exactly. And I stumbled upon this video of Tafel music playing and they're playing, it was part of their Galileo project. You can look it up on YouTube. They're standing up and it's so dynamic. They're playing Vivaldi, they're playing from memory. They're looking at each other, they're moving around the stage. And I was completely captivated and said, how do I get into that group? I want to play with those people. And so I wrote to a friend who I knew played Baroque violin and I said, where do I start? I said, I need lessons with people. And he's the one who gave me Jean's email address and also Julia Wedman's email address. And I reached out to them and asked them for lessons. And I thought, this can't be so hard. You just take a violin and put gut strings on it. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. It's like a completely different language. It's like, I don't know, you know, I can't compare it to like American English and like British English. It's more different than that. I mean, it's just wildly different from the techniques to the way you're using your bow, how it's physically set up, the relationship with the string, how temperamental it is. All of these stylistic things, like both rule-based, but also improvisation. Like there was a whole world I knew nothing about. And it was so deeply humbling. I mean, as someone who has like a pretty okay facility on my instrument and feel quite confident with intonation and with, you know, just getting around the instrument physically, it was like being a beginner again. And every time I put the Baroque violin away for a while and I pick it up again, it's like starting, it does feel like, okay, there's a learning curve again. Like it is so much more, intricate and it requires a lot more of you. It doesn't just like speak right away like a modern violin. And so that was my first introduction into learning how to play Baroque violin. And going between those two worlds is quite extraordinary. It's like the one world, like the violin, modern violin world feels to me like the modern world. It's like, it's efficient. It's powerful. It's like somehow like more corporate, like it's like well set up. And then this Baroque violin is like working with the earth. It's like getting your hands dirty in the garden and you're like really connected with nature. And it takes you back to a different time where we lived a little bit more simply and slowly and you need more patience. And I love going between those two worlds because sometimes you just like, I need immediate results and I just want efficiency. And then the modern violin's there for that. And then other times I want the craft of learning and playing an instrument. And that's the Baroque violin offers that for me.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Well, maybe we could play a clip of the LeClaire duo with Julia. you had lessons with her as well at a certain point. Do you have any sort of main thing from those lessons or the way she teaches?
Oh, Julia is a very holistic person and artist. And I would come in for a lesson and I would kind of like get ready to take the instrument out. And she'd say, let's sit down and have a cup of tea. And so we would speak for 30 minutes, like time would just go by, or for an hour. And she would just talk to me about music, or she would talk to me about some art exhibition that she had recently gone to. Just someone who's really alive in music and in art and the full expression of what it means to being a human being. And so I would learn so much from her and still do, just from listening to how she talks about everything from like body language and playing and affect. And she studied actors' facial expressions and how they internalize certain emotions quickly, how they come into joy in the body, how they come into like sadness and grief, and how she learned how to incorporate some of those aspects into performance. Like when she would talk about, for example, the Bach Shekhon, she's done quite a big deep dive into all of Bach's solo music for violin. And she'll look at how he has a piece that's so joyful, and then suddenly there's a sad passage, like, and it kind of comes out of nowhere, and it's like, it's brief, but it's there, and it really like takes you by surprise. Like, it's now in a minor key, and why are we here? And she says to me in one of my lessons, she says, have you ever been so in love that it hurts? And she's like, that's that expression for her. And like, how do you capture that in the music? And then she'll talk about the opposite, about being like in terrible, terrible grief, but still there's like this little part of you that sees hope. And it's kind of like what Leonard Cohen said. He said, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through. And she says, you know, and that for her is like, you never really truly believe in your grief, that like it's only grief. There has to be a way out. And that's Bach in some of these, like the D minor partita, she says, is like he kind of comes out of grief for a moment, and like you see the sun just emerging through the specks here. So she'll talk about that for like an hour, and then we'll get into the music. So just a deeply profound artist, a spiritual person, one of the best violinists and musicians I've ever come across. I'm so grateful to have been able to record those Jean-Marie Leclerc duos with her, and to be able to just have her in my life as an artist and musician.
Hi, just a really quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes. I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you. With Michael Bridge, Catherine Dowling, Ji-Yoon Kim, Clay Zeller-Townsend, and Jean Rowe. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commission from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Yolanda.
Yeah, I've played many of those Leclerc duos with my husband, who's a violinist, for fun. But a lot of people don't realize how much music Leclerc wrote. And like I said, like just these violin sonatas with continuo, there's over 40, and they're all so different. And he's such an interesting composer that I think isn't played enough. So just a pitch. And I know that the Jean Lemon really loved French Baroque music.
She loved French Baroque music, and she introduced me to Jean-Marie Leclerc, because just as you said, she told me something similar, that there's like a vast body of music to explore, and I had no idea. And so we recorded one of these duos. I think there are six of them, but there are tons of other pieces, the sonatas you mentioned. I think he was quite instrumental in developing this like French style of the time. He was the person that was influencing the violin technique of the time. And you're right that it's just not kind of part of the normal violin repertoire right now. It's not played as much, and it's great music. And I love that you and your husband play some of the duos together.
For sure. Oh, yeah. People will have heard my episode with Ruckus's artistic director, Clay Zeller-Townsend. And we talked a little bit about how they are commissioning new music and bringing the contemporary world and the Baroque world closer together, which Tafel Music also does. So on this album, you had a beautiful commission from Beth Silver, who's also the cellist in the La Dame Ensemble, which is featured in my episode with Michael. So there's a few connections there. And I didn't know that Jean Lemann's background was, so they were Sephardic Jews from the Netherlands.
That's correct. So her father was, his family were in the diamond cutting industry and had been for, I think, a long time. Like, his family's background was in diamond cutting, and the family expected him to pursue that as a profession. And he was just not having it. And in 1939, him and his wife decided they would take a year away from the business and go to the States. And then the war broke out, and the Second World War. And he could see more clearly from the States what was happening to the Jewish population in Europe. And he urged his family to leave. And many did, but many didn't. They lost a large number of their family to the Holocaust. And I didn't know this about Jean's heritage, about her background. And so I reached out. I thought, okay, I'd love a piece on this album that can honor Jean's Dutch Jewish heritage. And my mother's side of the family are Dutch, and that felt kind of special to have that connection. And I reached out to Beth Silver, who is really someone who's diving deep into klezmer music and into her own cultural background through music and improvisation and understanding stylistically what that means on a string instrument. And she did herself some research with someone at York University, and they looked into this piece called Kamti Lechalel, and it comes from a Seder poem from the 17th century in Holland. And the work describes the world's creation and its seventh day, the Sabbath, and the laws of the days of rest, of the day of rest. And that was the inspiration behind the new commission that Beth wrote for me, Violetta Kamti Lechalel, where she takes this original work and she incorporates it into something more personal for her. It's a beautiful composition. And I love that, you know, it is a work that's old from the 17th century, and I love that it's being played on a Baroque violin. But it's by a living composer. It's very profound. It's probably the most spiritual work on the album for myself.
Am I right that the family was Sephardic, like they'd come out of Spain in the Inquisition?
That I'm not sure.
Okay.
That I don't know.
I thought, yeah, I'd read that. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Because I know maybe the Dutch Jewish community was both sides of that. Yeah, you know, one of my daughters has lived in the Netherlands for many years, and I feel very close to that country, and had actually many Dutch artists on this podcast, and I study Dutch. It's like sort of it's a part of my life that I've learned a lot about the history. And yeah, I didn't know that you were part Dutch.
Yeah, my mother's side are Dutch, and my siblings and I and my mom all have a Dutch passport, thanks to my mom's side, which is wonderful. It's always kind of made the possibility of working and living in Europe a reality for us, which is in a time where things are changing a lot. It's just nice to have that.
Your sister is a cellist, and I remember both of you growing up in Ottawa and hearing you in Kiwanis Festival and other things. So it's wonderful to see both of your developments. And your mom's a violinist. So I assume you played music together growing up.
We did. We certainly did. Carmen plays cello. She lives in Quebec City, works with the Quebec Symphony Orchestra. And my mom is a violin teacher and was my first teacher Mom actually went into labor with me playing a concert. So music has really been in my brain and in my surroundings since early childhood. And it was definitely a very vibrant and musical home. I also have a younger brother who also for many years played violin, viola, and piano. So other than my father, who was completely non-musical and just a big support and a loving family member, there was a lot of music in the household, which was great.
That's really great. Now, I thought it'd be wonderful to also talk about your first album, The Wild Swans, from 2019. Very different. And so it's just such an accomplishment, this album, and very bold. And, you know, more and more people are putting out albums by all women composers. But it was less so in 2019. And you were young at the time. It was your first album.
Yeah. So this is The Wild Swans. This was a big undertaking as well. It was a time where I was kind of like I had just come back to Canada. We recorded that album in 2018. I was freelancing. I didn't have access to the same kind of resources that I have now. And so it was a lot to produce an album of that kind. And that was with my wonderful colleague, Isabelle David, who's playing on piano. That was a very special joint project. And we worked on that for probably 18 months. And, you know, I think that as an artist, I'm trying to like always work out this balance of what your values are as a human being, and then how you bring those into the work that you do. And I cannot separate those things. They have to coexist. And women's rights and gender equity is so important to me. And it would take me too long and would be too sad to describe to you the times in my early development where being a woman has been a disadvantage, or where I've experienced sexism, or I have been spoken down to because I'm described as like a little girl in master classes, just like terrible, terrible behavior from some professors and certain educational environments. And all of that has shaped me into the young person and young adult that I am today. And what kind of world do I want my little girl to be raised in? What kind of world do I want my students to be raised in? The people that I teach at the Glenn Gould School, for example. And I look at the programming of the major symphony orchestras, and it's all the same demographic of people that we're playing. It's just the same older white European composers. And there's so much fantastic music, but there is from that time. But there's also so much great new music by people from all over the world, men and women. And women are still so hugely underrepresented. So it's so funny because, of course, when you picked up this album and you looked at all these names, like Lili Boulanger, Elena Katz-Cherenin, Alexina Louis, Elena Langer, Kelly Marie Murphy, you're like, oh, these are all women composers. That's what this album is about. It's all women. But if I picked up another album and I saw like Bach, Vivaldi, Jean-Marie Leclerc, I wouldn't be like, oh, this is an album about all men composers. I would be like, what is the story? Like, and so for us, like, of course it was deliberate to have all these women, but the real like love of the album was like music steeped in storytelling. All of these composers' works are hugely imaginative. They push the extremes of both of our instruments, violin and piano. They incorporate some extended techniques. They use like languages that were kind of like, for example, Kala Ramnath, Indian classical violinist, she used extended techniques, and it's another language for us to incorporate into that storytelling of the album. It really pushed us. We went far, and then we recorded, you know, Hildegard von Bingen, which is like, is that 11th century? Like, it's very, very old music as well. And it was a really special project. And of course, like you said, it is an album of all women composers, and we do really, really want to promote women composers.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject that my interview with Kala Ramnath last year is one of my all-time, you know, most listened to episodes, and people should check it out. She's so special.
I will check it out. She is very special. That's wonderful you interviewed her.
I was familiar with many of the composers on this album, but not Auerbach, who wrote these 24 preludes for violin and piano. They're just fantastic.
They are, they really, those. That's an example of one of the works that really pushes the extreme of the instrument, both piano and violin. When we were researching Lehrer Auerbach, she is a profound artist. Like, she's written poetry, she's a painter. She defected from Russia to the United States when she was, I think, like 17 or 18. She's just a really quite an astonishing person. And there was one interview Isabel and I listened to where she was asked, if you could describe yourself in one word, what would it be? And she thought for a second and she said, fearless. And when we were recording her preludes, we're like, that's what you have to be to really convey this kind of music and to get it out. It's fearless music. And what a journey it was learning those pieces. We only recorded a few of them. I can't remember, maybe six of her her preludes, but the 24 are all astonishing.
Now, the Swan Parapraxis by Ottawa-based composer Kelly Marie Murphy is with your sister, Carmen.
Yes.
And I assume the title of the album came a little bit out of that?
Actually, The Wild Swans is from Hans Christian Andersen.
Okay.
It's from a fairy tale. But Kelly Marie Murphy knew that. She knew that we were going to call the album The Wild Swans, okay, and that we had this whole inspiration from Hans Christian Andersen. And so she somehow just went with the swan research, and then she found kind of a dark story, which is the story I think that the piece is about. I think it's an Irish folktale, and it's a man who's out hunting at dawn, and he sees what he thinks is a swan, and he shoots it, and it turns out to be his fiance. He accidentally kills his fiance. It's a tragic story. I'm not sure why it's been incorporated into folktale. It must have some connection to another story. And she wrote this piece, and Carmen and I commissioned it together, my sister Carmen on cello. And it's very interesting. Kelly is such a great composer, and she goes deep. And she goes and looks underneath the rock and sees like what's there. And what I really like about Kelly is that I don't know how to say this the most eloquently, but like she deals with darkness. Like, she deals with the subject of grief and the places where we're afraid to go. Mm-hmm. That's how I would describe her as a composer. She'll look in the areas that other people would be too scared to look. And she deals with those emotions. And that's what I feel we got from the Swan Parapraxis. And I really appreciate what she wrote for us. It's quite special.
I went to a concert of all of her chamber music this past summer at Ottawa's Chamber Fest. It was like her 60th birthday celebration. Mm-hmm. And actually the Canadian pianist Catherine Dowling was playing there, and she was on this podcast last year. And I discussed with Catherine the idea of beauty that's not pretty.
Catherine is a very, very good friend of mine and a big inspiration to me. So I love that you just brought up Catherine. And you're absolutely right. Like, Catherine's another artist who is looking at those other parts of the human experience that some of us are really afraid to deal with. And finding ways to bring that out in her storytelling, in her musical programming, in her way of speaking to audiences. And it's so courageous, and it's done incredibly poetically, and it's very profound, it's very personal. I really appreciate what she offers as an artist. Would you like to talk about Music for Your Blues?
Yes, I was just going to mention that. Yes, you know, because we were just talking about emotions, and I did want to bring up Music for Your Blues, which is ongoing. And does it involve other people or just yourself?
Music for Your Blues is myself, but it has involved other people as well. So Music for Your Blues is a volunteer online project, musical project that I founded in 2021 in the middle of the pandemic. And essentially what it is in the winter months, specifically January, where we know, there's the coined expression, January blues, when depression hits hardest. It's like the lowest time of the year. Not a lot of sunlight in this part of the world. It's very cold outside. It's after the holidays. All your money has been spent. There's not much to look forward to until spring, which is a long time from now. So I launched this project where I offered 30-minute free musical performances over Zoom. And anybody can sign up anywhere in the world. So it goes online onto an online calendar, and you just select, and then I show up on a screen just like this, and I play 20 minutes of music, and I share a little bit of poetry and storytelling, and we have a very personal, like one-on-one or one and maybe two people musical performance. And that grew out of the pandemic. And that has got to be one of the most rewarding ways I've ever shared music. Just, we talk about the research and, you know, the connection music can make with between people and audiences and the effects on the brain. But that level of intimacy and sharing it in that way really was the first time I really saw in real time just how much the impact of music and connection can benefit our lives. So I have done it primarily alone. I have also hired other artists to do it as well. And it runs every winter, and it's usually done over a period of 2 weeks, and there are different dates and people sign up for them. And then I will share music and poetry by Maya Angelou, maybe Margaret Atwood. We'll talk a little bit sometimes about a philosophy. We'll bring in Carl Sagan, the American astronomer, and tie that to music and conversation and have a really intimate 30 minutes together through music and story.
So you're a reader?
I am a reader, yes. Just as you're asking that, I'm like, right now, I haven't picked up a book that's not a baby book for like maybe a few weeks. But yes, I am a reader. I love sitting with poetry because it's like it's short and it is high impact. And then reflecting, like just when I have the time and space, I actually like to write down a poem, like slowly by hand, and just kind of take it in. That's I think, the amazing thing about poetry is that usually it's not very long, and that it's dealing with something very specific, a human emotion or experience or something that you've probably overlooked, and it can really have a high impact very quickly.
Yeah, I've got back into reading poetry. I did as like a teenager, and then I hadn't. And recently I have more. Someone who's important in my life has been writing a lot of poetry and kind of got me more interested in that. Another person I interviewed, Ji-Yoon Kim, such a special pianist, and the way she presents concerts with poetry and visual images and and her books, it's all integrated. It's really wonderful. So many. I'll send you a book of poetry I've been reading. I've just recently, I never thought I'd do this, but I've gotten into being like an e-reader. I got a Kobo, not a Kindle because it's owned by Amazon. And
good for you.
And what I love is I can just really use my public library and have so many different books on it. So like wow. Just switching between genres. And if I'm, it's such a wonderful gift to be able to do that. Now, in terms of the Music for Your Blues, I was just thinking about, you know, memorable performances. You know, one of my very first paid, I think it might have been my first paid gig when I was a teenager at McGill first year, someone hired, they wanted a string quartet for a birthday party. And so we got like some kind of gig book from somebody. We were going to sight read, and we show up, and it was a tiny little apartment, and it was this man and his adult children, and there were maybe four people, and it was really a private concert for him. It wasn't like an event or a reception as we thought. So they were just right there, and he wanted to record it. He had a little tape recorder. So it was a lesson in always being prepared, I must say. And we did our best, and we poured our heart into it, but we weren't prepared as we should have been for that type of concert, but it was so memorable.
I bet. Is it, when you say prepared, do you mean because it was like a little bit too intimate, like that, like you had, were expected to speak more than you expected?
Or we didn't have a proper program, right? Like we had a gig book. I think we really thought it would be like cocktails and we'd be background music, right?
I see. Well, I mean, that was misleading. They hired you in the wrong way because you were prepared for a different gig. What an experience. Yeah, I love house concerts. I mean, a lot of the music that we play was designed for that kind of smaller, you know, 100 people in a room or 50 people in a room environment. And I long for that. I mean, of course, it's not a great financial model. I mean, that's why the halls are so big. Like, if you want to pay a lot of musicians, it's expensive. And so you need a lot of butts and seats. So you need a big, big space. But that kind of intimacy of sharing art so close in proximity, being able to speak directly to a public that they can actually like really hear the rawness of the sound of the violin so close, or any instrument, and you're speaking so close. I mean, just watching someone play, you sit in an orchestra and see the world's best soloists come in week after week. And I'm sure there are times like you're so distracted. You're playing and you're like, wow, I would do anything. I'm just like meters away from Yo-Yo Ma, or like meters away from Hilary Hahn. And like, how did she do that? And it's just astonishing to witness something like that in close proximity, different from sitting at the back of the hall. So I love that intimacy of home concerts for that reason, just the watching, and it's exciting.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the intimacy of the stage that way. I don't think the audience maybe realizes our experience, how it can be.
Mm-hmm. Being so close, you're really drawn in, and like the level of the detail that you hear when you're that close. I mean, you hear like certain people breathing, like you can feel like if they're anxious, you can really see it in their body language because they're just there like meters away from you. It's so exhilarating, that human experience through live performance.
I know you've done quite a bit of outreach in different kind of communities, and you've played in a high security penitentiary as well.
Yes, that was through a foundation called Looking at the Stars. And their mission was specifically to bring music into penitentiaries. And we went to a high and medium security penitentiary in Kingston, Ontario. And we played performances for inmates. And that was a very, very different and very profound experience in itself. You see in a room like that your own privilege, and that like how lucky you are to have been born into a stable, loving family, and how your own life could have been completely different had you just a few circumstances been different. And you also see when you see a group of individuals who are always treated in a certain way, like always treated like criminals and always treated as dangerous citizens of society, and what that will do to you psychologically when you're always treated like you're worthless or you're dangerous. I cannot speak to arguing against how the system is set up. I'm not well educated enough, but you see the ability that, like, what it means when you offer something like music and you speak to somebody with human dignity and with respect and with kindness and love in the sound in your voice. You see the immediate impact of that, like how that can shape another person and their experience in the world. And you can see it in the day-to-day life of how we interact with our friends or our children or a stranger on the street who's having a hard time. But when you're dealing with individuals who have suffered a lot in their lives and you offer that kind of kindness and generosity through music, you see it more profoundly in real time. the impact of how we communicate with one another and how that can shape different people's experiences in life.
Last year, I had Jean Rowe on the podcast. She's an incredible songwriter, and she said some of the most meaningful work she's done has been songwriting workshops in penitentiaries.
Wow, fantastic. I can only imagine.
And then, do you know the Canadian pianist Heather Taves?
I recognize the name. Tell me about Heather.
Well, she has this Beethoven blog, so you might have heard her about a Beethoven journey. Anyway, she was on the podcast, and she's also a writer. And we were talking about one of her writing mentors, the Kingston writer, Diane Schoenperlin. So I always go down these rabbit holes. So when I was researching Heather, I was like, who is this, you know, well-known Canadian author I didn't know about? And then I read this incredible memoir of hers, This Is Not My Life, by Diane. It's about her, how she fell in love with this murderer in penitentiary and that relationship, and a lot about the system and the psychology of it. It's a very interesting and moving and super well-written memoir. So I recommend that book.
I will look that up. Yeah, there are people living completely different lives than we are and have had very different lived experiences. And they have grown up just kilometers away from us.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what you see when you go into a penitentiary. It's just, society is complex and has many different shades. And I find in our world, and maybe you would agree, that we can live in a little bit of a silo sometimes, like our little classical music, our little music bubble, our arts bubble. And we are very privileged. And of course, there are challenges to some of the things we do, but we are very, very lucky and very privileged. And I'm trying to find ways to get out of just the small environment that I live in and learn about other people's lived experiences and to have a deeper, more profound understanding of the human experience and see what ways we can help each other and shape each other's lives for the better.
I'm curious because you were living, I believe, in the Netherlands and England for a while when you were studying.
I lived in London for 5 years.
Okay.
I just spent a few months in Amsterdam, but I would have loved to have lived in Holland. But I lived in England for 5 years, and that was a real big experience for me as a young person. I moved there when I was 20 years old, or 21, and very informative years of my life, and a different culture. Same language, but very different culture. Different way of living, different social behaviors, different ways of looking at other populations. Like in Canada, we are such a diverse community of people who come from all over the world. The English have a different relationship with people that come from different places. We're really seeing that right now prominently in the news with everything happening in the world. So that was a very interesting experience for me to live there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if maybe you want to address a little bit the way you learn music. Obviously, you're a fantastic violinist, but you have a lot to process. You're in the Toronto Symphony and you have all these other projects. So how do you have like a routine or a way of working?
Oh, such a good question. Do I have a routine? Okay, no, I don't have a real routine. I do have certain things that I love and that I try to get the balance of every year. I love my orchestral work, but I also love playing chamber music. I love teaching. I love doing outreach work like Music for Your Blues or performing for different communities, like in a jail, for example, a penitentiary. And I also like working with different artists and living composers and meeting people from different fields and learning from them. So my hope is that in every 12-month period, that I've been able to do a number of those types of projects. That the variety is very rewarding, and working, for example, on modern violin, but also working during the year a little bit on Baroque violin as well. And all of that informs my work. Part of routine for Michael, my partner, and I is also, this might change now with a little baby girl, but we typically take the month of August off from working. So we'll work for 11 months in the year, but then, you know, like we financially plan to be off in August, and that is our month to really rest, because when you go for too long, you burn out and the creative flame starts to fizzle. You need time. You need unstructured time, and a unstructured time in a day, but also to see many days in a row where the calendar is empty, mm-hmm. where you can learn new things and you can explore and you can dive deep into something, or you can just rest and daydream, which is so good for the brain. I remember reading the Roman philosopher Stoic Seneca said, if there are two things that you do every single day, they are walk and read. And that's what August is usually dedicated to.
Wonderful. Well, that is a great place to wrap up, unless there's something we didn't talk about that you'd really like to talk about.
I feel we had a great conversation today. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Thanks for being here.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.